Hello, and welcome to class session number 21, our final class on The Hobbit.
Anyway, okay, so at the end of class last time, we were talking about luck and the larger patterns that we can begin to see in the luck of Bilbo and his companions, and I want to just kind of pick up on that a little bit more as we go through the end of the story. We can see, as I was talking about last time, the kind of conspiracy of events, even those which seem to be both a combination of unfortunate events which happen from outside and a combination of their own bad choices too, kind of like Turin if you think about it. Some bad things that they do and some bad things that just happen to them, all of which conspire to lead them on this uniquely fortunate path. It all turns out exactly, it could not have turned out well any other way. And when they get towards the end of this path, their luck and the discussion of luck begins to take a different kind of turn, that is, a different emphasis on it. We begin to talk about actual prophecy, not just, gosh, isn't it funny that these fortunate things keep happening. When they get to Lake Town, there's this discussion of these songs, ancient to the men who live there, of course, these songs that sing of the return of the king under the mountain, that someday the king under the mountain will return. And we see several different levels of response to these songs. That is, first we get some spontaneous and highly naive responses by many of the men of the lake. You remember when Thorin shows up, when Thorin and Bilbo... They're going as scouts into the town because and Fili and Kili, I think, because they're the only four like conscious members of the party. The rest of them are all passed out from having just been gotten out of the barrels. And they go in and they're all bedraggled and everything. And Thorin steps into the guardhouse and says, "I am Thorin, son of Thrain, son of Thrord, king under the mountain. I have returned." And in response to this, several of the guards run out of the building and look up towards the mountain, like they expect to see rivers of gold immediately starting to flow. And I mean, this is obviously a kind of a silly reaction, an extreme on the naivete front. But nevertheless, it shows that these people clearly take these prophecies seriously. What's the elves' response? There are some elves there too. That is the raftmen of the king who are rafting down with the barrels. How do they respond to the revelation of the king under the mountain, returned, the longed for, that cometh at unawares, which has happened here in Lake Town? Travis?
Well, at first they just like tell the master of the city, you know, these guys are prisoners, I don't know what they're talking about, you should probably give them back.
Right, exactly. These are escaped prisoners. This is not the homecoming foretold of old. And Thorin is able to accommodate this, right? It is true that we were wrongfully waylaid, but nothing can forestall the homecoming foretold of old. And then everyone, you know, this that remarkable enthusiasm. The elves, that's their first response. Hey, no, these are just some vagabond dwarves. But the elves start to get afraid and begin to think that perhaps their king has made a serious miscalculation. The elves take these prophecies seriously, too. And when they see what's happening, they're like, dang, maybe this is actually... a major movement of something that's supposed to happen. And maybe by imprisoning Thorin and trying to stop him, you know, the Elfin King has gotten on the wrong side of this prophecy. They clearly take it seriously. Who takes it least seriously?
Isn't it the Master of Lake Town?
The Master of Lake Town, whose focus is all on tolls and trade and income, right? Money bags, as he will be called by the people, disparagingly later on, right? But even he comes around when the dwarves are getting ready to leave, right? He believes from the beginning that Thorin's a fraud, and he's waiting for him to be exposed. And so he pushes at the end for them to go, thinking that the dwarves are never going to actually go up to the Lonely Mountain and do anything with Smaug. I mean, he believes that this is never going to occur. And then when Thorin starts talking about this, even the master begins to get afraid. Whoa, they're seriously going to go after the dragon? Maybe there really is something to this. So everyone, on some level or another, begins to take this seriously, that this guy might really be the king under the mountain and that the old prophecies are really going to come true. As I mentioned before, very briefly, we've already seen a prophecy about this. We don't need to hear about the songs in Lake Town in order to know that there's a prophecy. There was a prophecy written on the map. What's written in moon letters? You remember what is written? What are the instructions? In plain letters is written, you know, 4 feet high and three may walk abreast, with a little hand pointing to the side of the mountain where the secret door entrance is. The moon letters talk about the thrush knocking, Endurance Day, remember? Stand by the gray stone when the thrush knocks, and the setting sun with the last light of Durin's day will shine upon the keyhole. Okay, notice even the tense of this, right? This is not, the first part is instruction, stand by the gray stone when the thrush knocks, but even when the thrush knocks is a prophetic statement. There's going to be a thrush there, and the thrush is going to knock. And at that moment, on Durin's day, stand in this one place, and the sun, the last light of Durin's day will shine upon the keyhole, and that's how it will be revealed. From beginning to end, it's a prophecy. And of course, the thrush turns out to be not just a random element of this prophecy. That is, it's not just you shall know that you are in the right place if there's a thrush there. But of course, the thrush itself is one of the primary vehicles of the great events that are happening. If there were not a thrush on that stone, then Smaug would never die. Well, I mean, wouldn't be killed here. Remember Bilbo's comment to himself that, you know, that he didn't expect anyone to remember that he was the one who discovered the weak point in Smaug's armor, which is just as well because no one ever did remember or give him credit for that. Well, even fewer people remember or give credit to the thrush for what the thrush... I mean, it's the thrush and Bilbo are the two who are instrumental in connecting the dot there between Smaug and his armor and Bard with his bow, right? So the prophecy of the moon letters includes, though it doesn't describe the role of the thrush itself, which, again, if it hadn't been there, there would have been no point in the secret door. In other words, from the beginning, there's clearly something larger going on here. When they get the map at the beginning, Thorin is hopeful that this will give us some kind of advantage. This at least gives us perhaps the beginnings of a plan for what to do when we get to the mountain. Remember, Bilbo would sort of like to point out the fact that getting rid of Smaug has always been a weak spot in their plans. They've just been focused on getting to the Lonely Mountain and then not really knowing what to do when they get there. But it turns out they don't need to know what to do when they get there. That what becomes clearer and clearer, they're just instruments of a larger thing, of a larger prophecy, of a larger movement, which again, the elves are beginning to smell that. And it becomes clearer and clearer until... And Bilbo and his luck, his unusual luck, is one of the chief instruments of it. We talked about some of the passages which, you know, begin to more and more locate luck, not just in the random events surrounding this, but in Bilbo personally, right? That passage, Aaron, I think it was you that read about his three very useful possessions, right? Being, wits, a magic ring, and luck. That moment, Tony, that you recalled where luck of an unusual kind was with him on the night when they escape in the barrels. You know, his whole attitude has changed it. You know, Thorin, in his big impressive speech when they get through the secret door, draws attention to the fact that an unusual allowance of luck Bilbo has. And he says, maybe I've taken to trusting my luck more than I used to back in the old days, by which he means last year, you know, last summer, a few months ago. But now he trusts to his luck. Why is Bilbo along in the first place? Why did they get somebody?
He's a burglar. Right.
He's a professional burglar, yes. That's why they... Well, again, then they couldn't find a hero. But why were they looking for... They were looking for somebody else. And so when they're looking for somebody else, they decide, well, ideally they'd like to get a hero or a warrior, but they'll settle for a burglar if they can't, but...
Oh, because they have 13 and that's unlucky.
He's the lucky number, right? As he labels himself to the dragon. He's brought along for luck from the beginning. The other thing, the other phrase from back from chapter 1, which in retrospect really resonates throughout this the whole book, he's not just the lucky number. He is not just the agent and instrument of luck throughout this story. He is also, as Gandalf labels him in chapter 1, the chosen and selected burglar. When this thing begins to look more and more like some kind of conspiracy and less like a series of fortunate and unfortunate events, all of which seem to be leading towards this remarkable end, it begins to seem that, yes, he actually has been chosen and selected and not just by Gandalf. Gandalf, of course, in the end, draws attention to this. And he and Bilbo end the book with an explicit discussion of this. There on the last page, on 272. "Then the prophecies of the old songs have turned out to be true after a fashion," says Bilbo. "Of course," said Gandalf. "And why should not they prove true? Surely you don't disbelieve the prophecies because you had a hand in bringing them about yourself? You don't really suppose, do you, that all your adventures and escapes were managed by mere luck just for your sole benefit? You are a very fine person, Mr. Baggins, and I am very fond of you, but you are only quite a little fellow in the wide world after all." Now, what's the emphasis here? Tell me what we learn from that last passage. Because it's I think there are several things. Marta?
Well, it's funny because you were just saying that he was chosen and selected. But in this point, Gandalf kind of says, well, you are very little, though. I mean, you are a tool in this grand plan, and that grand plan isn't yours, after all.
Yeah, yeah. Bilbo is thinking of the adventure as his adventure, right? And therefore, doesn't think of it in these big sweeping senses. This is just his own his adventure. His little subtitle for his book is There and Back Again, right? This is the story of Bilbo's title for the book is There and Back Again, A Hobbit's Holiday, right? Here's like what I did on my vacation. And Gandalf is pointing out both, this is much bigger than just you. Yes, of course these larger prophecies came true. You don't disbelieve the prophecies just because you happen to be in. Just because you think of it as your story doesn't mean that you were, that this was not also part of the bigger picture. But of course, also, as you say, that doesn't make you big, right? That doesn't mean that you were the instrument of destiny here. But in the end, it was about more than you. And you were one part, played an important part. But in the end, this wasn't your story, Bilbo. You were part of a much bigger story. This as the ending of the story is, I think, very important, very significant. Because throughout, the story seems simple. His tone and his vocabulary throughout, this is a simple little story about Hobbit's holiday, right? But he is drawing attention to, this is just a little part of a much bigger story. There will be a famous moment that we will come back and talk about in The Lord of the Rings when Frodo and Sam are talking to each other about stories and taking part in stories. It's a really important moment. It comes in the Two Towers. Watch out for that. But you can see what Gandalf is talking to Bilbo here, being connected with that, showing to Bilbo, you're part of a big story. There's a large story going on here, and it's not about, you're not the hero of this story, even though he was used importantly in that story. Speaking of things being used as part of a larger story, though, we get a couple of eucatastrophes at the end of this story. What are some of the eucatastrophes we get? One of the classic Tolkien eucatastrophes happens at the end of The Hobbit. Marta?
When Bilbo looks up and he's like, the eagles are here.
Yes, the eagles are coming. Bilbo's jumping around and crying out, squeaking at the top of his voice. The eagles are coming! The eagles are coming! It should have that eucatastrophic feel to it. Tolkien comments on this in one of his letters, actually, going back and rereading The Hobbit after years after he'd written it. He commented on that particularly and said, you know, coming back to it years later, The Coming of the Eagles does have that eucatastrophic feeling to it. I mean, it does have exactly the, give exactly the kind of, you know, the kind of thrill that a real eucatastrophe should have. It's one of the things that he kind of looked back on The Hobbit and was kind of satisfied with. The arrival of the Eagles, definitely a eucatastrophe. We hear about another one, though we don't see it. What's the turning point in the battle? When is the battle officially over?
When Beorn shows up.
Beorn shows up, and dang, get out of his way. I mean, he just starts throwing, you know, like, he just charges. Like, he comes in and attacks the goblin army from the rear by himself, like, charges into the rear of the goblin army, throwing them all over the place. Takes a break, right, picks up Thorin's body, takes him over. Here you go, take care of Thorin. Hang on, I'm going to go back and finish routing the army single-handedly. And then, wham, he comes back in, scatters the bodyguard of Bolg, takes down Bolg, the king of the goblins, and then we're done. Right? At that point, the battle's over. So Beorn's arrival is, you know, we hear about it. It is also eucatastrophic. Again, notice, what is eucatastrophic about them? They are unexpected. They are unpredictable. They are these acts of grace. Things, it looked like everything was going to be bad, and then all of a sudden, they have no reason to expect the eagles to come into it to help them, right? The eagles live very far away. It's not their business, right? I mean, they're here fighting this. They're trapped. They have no, they wouldn't ever even have thought to call in the eagles for help. And then, wham, they come in and rescue them. Yeah.
But we did know they were coming because it was mentioned earlier.
We knew they were coming, yes. That is, we knew that they were, we saw that set in motion, yes. And so the anticipation of that, I think, actually augments rather than diminishing from our experience of it there at the end. But from the point of view of the people involved, it's not like, you know, they sent out for help from the eagles, right? But another thing that I'd like to point out, I think sometimes when we think about eucatastrophe at the end of this book, we tend to think of the turning points in the battle, which are, again, plainly eucatastrophic. But notice, the battle itself is a eucatastrophe. It's the worst thing that happens in the whole book. That is, I mean, it's the most tragic event. I mean, all these people die, and he emphasizes that it's a horrible experience. But remember the situation: the goblins come in. First of all, the arrival of the goblins is just as sudden and unexpected as the arrival of the eagles is. And when does it happen? What is happening when the goblins charge in? You remember the moment when that attack occurs? It's a very important moment. Aaron?
It's right as the dwarves are about to, like, sneak attack the elves and the men.
Yes. It comes in exactly before. I mean, had the goblins come 10 minutes later, the dwarves and elves and men would have been in battle. You may remember, this is the tense moment that has been building up, right? That we've had the demand. Bilbo has handed over the Arkenstone. They had the parley where they offered a bargain with the Arkenstone. They've made arrangements for this. But while the night after Thorin agrees to hand over the gold in exchange for the Arkenstone, he sends messengers to tell Dan, his cousin, to hurry up, right? And get there. So they march, the dwarves march all night and arrive there in the morning, and they're in this standoff. The elves and men are trying to prevent the dwarves from getting into the mountain and reinforcing Thorin, knowing that it's going to get ugly if they do, and the dwarves, recognizing that they're both trying to keep them out and hesitating to attack them, charge in. I mean, they're starting to attack them. They're actually, like, running across the field towards each other, about to fight, when all of a sudden Gandalf pops up and says, the goblins are here, everybody stop. And immediately, boom, all conflict is off, right? Immediately, Dan and the Elven King and Bard, all three of them get together. Okay, we've got to quickly strategize how to fight the goblins. Right? The battle is itself a eucatastrophe. All of a sudden, out of nowhere, everyone is saved. Think what was going to happen. They're trying to make Thorin think about what's going to happen. Gandalf is trying to make Thorin think about what's going to happen. The ravens are trying to make Thorin think about what's going to happen. Think about what you're doing. Even if we win, Even if the dwarves beat the humans and the elves or survive, they're going to have established enemies all throughout their region. I mean, the raven keeps saying, what are you going to do this winter? How are you going to eat? Remember, back in the old days, the dwarves didn't bother to grow any food. Why not? It was given to them because they could trade for it. They were fed by the humans who lived around them and who received in exchange the craftsmanship of the dwarves. What made the Lonely Mountain powerful, what made it significant, was not just the wealth of the dwarves, but the harmony in which they lived, especially with the humans. Though they were at peace also with the elves. And now, so now you're gonna alienate everybody? Now you're gonna surround the mountain entirely with enemies? How are we gonna eat? The treasure will be your death, Thorin, says the raven to him, trying to talk him out of this. That danger is averted, and suddenly and completely averted by the arrival of the goblins. And now everything is different. If not for the arrival of the goblins, we would have had terrible war. Again, had they even been delayed, had they come 12 hours later, they would have won, because right there, the elves and humans and dwarves would all have been killing each other for a day. And then the goblins would have come in and mopped up, right? So by coming exactly when they did, they forestalled war. And not just forestalled war, they created peace. They created alliance. And as a result of the battle that happens, now we have real peace. Now we have real companionship among them. And we see Dan and Bard making arrangements with the gold. We see Dale beginning to be rebuilt. We see new and an even stronger peace being established between the dwarves and the elves. All because, thank goodness, we had a battle this day. All because the goblins were indulging their greed for the dragon's treasure, were indulging their desire for vengeance against the dwarves. That is for lots of bad reasons. But here, as in other places, those who choose to do evil things for evil reasons will prove but Iluvatar's instrument in the making of things more wonderful than they could possibly imagine. And thus, the most horrible thing becomes the greatest eucatastrophe. Even the victory in the battle doesn't quite compare, in some ways, the significance of the battle itself and the changes that the battle itself brings about. This kind of thing is totally why we read the Silmarillion first before we read the other things, because there's so much of this stuff, just these overall patterns in Tolkien's thinking, which the Silmarillion really spotlights, and which you can see all over the place after you see them in the Silmarillion. I'm thinking about Bilbo, specifically about his identity as a burglar and his whole Took versus Baggins thing that we've seen going on since chapter one. When they open the door, the secret door, Thorin gives his big impressive speech. Now is the time for Bilbo to earn his reward, for him to perform the deed that they brought him to do. This is time for you to do what you've been hired to do. Now it's time for him officially to be a burglar. Now we've seen him already being a burglar and becoming more and more efficiently and effectively burglarious over the course of the book, right? But this is now your official burglar's duty. Go down the secret tunnel and see. And what happens? What does he do? In this moment when he is officially fulfilling his burglar's job. Now he's, they thought he looked more like a grocer than a burglar. Now he's officially, formally the burglar, and off he goes. What does he do?
And?
Well, he proves himself to be a burglar because he successfully takes a golden cup.
He takes the golden cup, two-handled golden cup from Smaug's lair, from the hoard, and comes up with it. And he himself recognizes in doing this he has fulfilled his charge. He has succeeded as a burglar. And there's some similarity, at least I would draw some similarity, between his outlook here and his outlook back with the trolls, the first time he ever self-consciously tried to do something burglarious, right? There's that same sense of, I must live up to my job, right? I must be a burglar. And the difference, of course, being that then he had no idea what he was doing and was kind of fumbling around for something burglarious to do. Now he knows exactly what a burglar would do, and is very proud of having passed the grade, right? You remember, what is he thinking to himself as he's running with the cup back up the tunnel? On page 194, do you find it, Ken?
I've done it. I'm more like a grocer than a burglar indeed.
Exactly.
We'll hear no more of that.
Exactly. More like a grocer than a burglar indeed. He's thinking back exactly to proving himself, right back to that scene in chapter 1. I have proven myself. I am really a burglar. I am not a grocer. I have arrived. But what he does is disastrous. Not only does no good come of this, very bad comes of this. He effectively rouses Smaug for no... I mean, hooray, we have a golden cup on the side of the mountain. There's no point to it. Again, no positive point to it. And they get mad at him, right? All the dwarves are real happy to start with, and then Smaug attacks them, and they almost lose Bofur and Bomber, and they finally get everybody, and then they start blaming Bilbo. Oh, good job, Bilbo, stirring up the dragon. And Bilbo appropriately says, well, what did you expect me to do? I'm a burglar. I'm not a hero. You didn't hire me to kill the dragon. You hired me to steal treasure. I stole treasure. You ought to have brought 500 burglars, he says, right? I have fulfilled my identity. And when he does, it's kind of disastrous. Now, later on, he says, just as conspicuously, now I am a burglar indeed. When does he say that? This is not the stealing of the cup, which was pointless. Elise?
When he takes the stone?
Yes. When he picks up the Arkenstone and hides it inside his pocket, he says, now I am a burglar indeed. And it's interesting because the golden cup appears to be him doing exactly what the dwarves would want, him fulfilling exactly his role. But it has a really bad outcome. Taking the Arkenstone, I mean, when he says, now I'm a burglar indeed, he appears to be thinking, because now I'm burgling from the dwarves. He knows, he suspects at that moment that he should not be taking this thing, and not, at least not to conceal it and to keep it. And later on, he knows full well he shouldn't be keeping it. I mean, when Thorin starts to be making threats of what he will do to anyone he finds hiding the Arkenstone, and he's thinking uncomfortably about the Arkenstone wrapped in his pillow, right? He knows he's not doing what he's supposed to be doing here, but, ironically, just as doing what he was supposed to do had bad results, doing now what he's not supposed to do, being a burglar indeed, has really good results. Gandalf affirms this, right? When, in the chapter conspicuously called A Thief in the Night, when he sort of goes on to fulfill his advanced burglar's role, stealing the Arkenstone, handing it off so that he can try to make peace between the dwarves and the elves and men, Gandalf approves him. Well done, Mr. Baggins. And he's very happy with this. Notice Thorin also applies the label. When Bilbo admits up on the wall that they've built, that he was the one who gave them the Arkenstone, right? Thorin picks him up and shakes him, and he's so angry at him, he's insulting him, he can barely get the words out. You descendant of rats, he calls him. You undersized burglar. Yes, yes, he is a burglar indeed. That's what he's supposed to do. He is, he, and he's
the chosen and selected burglar. Here he's fulfilling the role as burglar he was supposed to fulfill. But notice, why does he do this? What drives him to do this? Why does he keep the Ark and Stone and hand it off to Bard? What's his thought process? Aaron?
He said he claims when he first picks up the stone, he's like, this is going to be my 1/14th of the treasure. I feel like he's just trying to rationalize keeping the stone.
Yes, at first he picks it up just because he's really drawn to it. It's really beautiful. Yeah, that's his first, and that's why he keeps it. And he says, yeah, he said I could pick my own 14th share, and I think if I got nothing else, I'd like to have this. Later on, he knows full well, you know, even at the moment, he's like, yeah, I'm not sure that my choice was meant to extend to this thing, but, and then later on, he knows exactly well that it isn't. But you're right. It would be misleading to suggest that Bilbo's motivations towards the Ark and Stone are 100% pure from the beginning, because they're not. They're not. And we see him come under the influence of the dragon spell, of the lust of the hoard, a couple times. The first time he sees it, it happens to him. When he sees the Ark and Stone, it happens again. But he's not affected by the dragon sickness very much, or for very long. Some are very susceptible to it, like the Master of Lake Town. And Thorin. But Bilbo, he's not. Why not? What protects Bilbo from the dragon sickness? As it's called in the case of the Master of Lake Town.
Thorin kind of has what he wants back in Hobbit, and he knows it. I mean, he's been rambling about it the whole entire book. Just, oh, my nice comfy chair by the warm fire. He likes the comforts. He doesn't want shiny.
Yeah, exactly. He doesn't, he's not, yeah, treasure is not his goal. His own fireside back at home is his goal, right? He's looking forward to the back again. He's thinking about going home. Remember his egg riddle with Gollum? A box without hinges, key, or lid, yet inside golden treasure is hid. Now, it's conspicuous from the beginning that here he is on the quest for the dragon's treasure in Lonely Mountain, and he's standing in a cave beneath a mountain telling a riddle about golden treasure. But it's not gold, right? The answer to the riddle is an egg. Exactly. And we can, and I think especially in the context of Gollum's riddles, we should be with his mentioning of eggs, be thinking about birth and life as opposed to death and consumption that Gollum is talking about. But at the same time, in a much simpler way, it's also eggs and bacon, right? It's also his own affirmation of life and his land of comfortable things. When he is sitting on the wall that they've built in the Lonely Mountain with the army spread around beneath him and the dwarves singing about the treasure and about coming war, he's up there thinking about eggs and bacon again. That's his treasure. And this protects him from the desire for the other treasure. He's got what he wants, or he knows what he wants, and he wants to get back to what he wants. In other words, it's his Baggins side that really protects him. At the beginning, the grocer versus burglar, duality there with Bilbo in chapter one looks like Baggins versus Took, right? His Baggins side, you know, I bet Bungo Baggins did look a lot like a grocer. And he seems more like a grocer, certainly more than like a burglar. Burglary is a Tookish thing. And when he goes in and signs up to be the burglar, this is characterized as his Took side had won, right? So we're invited to connect burglary with Tookishness and all of his resistance to adventure with his Baggins side. And this continues. You remember when he begins to come home, we're told that, you know, that the Took side was getting very tired and the Baggins side getting stronger and stronger. He ceases more and more to be interested in adventure and wants just to get home. Of course, he's always wanted to get home. And he's never stopped thinking about home. But here,
Ironically, in the final stages of his adventure, his final fulfillment of his role, of his identity as burglar, comes when he is acting Bagginsish, not when he's acting Tookish. You see? It is him being Bagginsish. Notice how he even adopts his very Baggins-like business manner when he is talking to Bard and the Elven King and negotiating with them. Thorin recognizes this of him in the end and recognizes that Bilbo's combination of Tookishness and Bagginsishness is a very good thing and has protected him. This is Thorin's dying words to Bilbo on 259. At the very bottom of 258. There is more in you of good than you know, child of the kindly West. Some courage and some wisdom blended in measure. If more of us valued food and cheer and song above hoarded gold, it would be a merrier world. But sad or merry, I must leave it now. Farewell. If more of us valued food and cheer and song above hoarded gold. This is Thorin apologizing. Not just for the things that he said to Bilbo on the wall, you know, descendant of rats, etc., but for falling into the dragon sickness, for putting everybody in jeopardy, for choosing war and violence and greed and vengeance for the sake of gold. What's Bilbo called by the Elven King? Elf friend, significantly. This is, we will see in the Fellowship of the Ring, a significant title which stays with you. But he's given a personal title by the Elven King.
It's just a couple pages later on 263.
Bilbo the Magnificent.
There it is. Bilbo the Magnificent. And I name you Elf Friend and Blessed. Earlier on in their first meeting, during the Thief in the Night chapter, the Elven King gives Bilbo one of the most awesomely backhanded compliments that you ever hear. Bilbo Baggins, you are more worthy to wear the armor of elf princes than many that have looked more comely in it. The armor of elf princes. When Bilbo puts on the elf prince armor that Thorin gives him there in the hall, he says, I feel rather magnificent, but I expect that, you know, he expects that people back home would laugh at him if they saw him wearing his armor. He feels magnificent in the elf armor, but suspects that really it's a little bit silly. The Elven King, although the Elven King has already recognized that he doesn't look very good in it, that he does in fact look silly wearing the elf armor, nevertheless gives him, in exactly that same word, that title, Bilbo the Magnificent. Not because of how he looks or what he's wearing, but because of what he does, both with the Arkenstone. And he names him Bilbo the Magnificent in response to the gift.
Right. I'm assuming that the magnificence is sort of in the tradition of that specific kingly virtue and not just necessarily overall awesomeness.
Yeah. It is... Yes, in the tradition of the kingly virtue. It's a significant thing to be called magnificent. It's a complicated word, but it's a word, certainly, whose history Tolkien would have been thinking about when he applied it. And it's another example of one of so many words which we have cheapened over time. There's so many words which we use just to mean superlative in a large but vague way, which had, of course, much more specific, a whole wealth of connotations, which we kind of ignore nowadays.
What happens to Bilbo when he goes home?
The stuff's getting cold.
Comes. It's like another U catastrophe, right? And then everyone's like, oh, Bilbo's dead. Let's sell off his stuff. And then he returns from the dead, except they don't feel it to be, especially the Sackville Bagginses do not feel that this is a, there's nothing U about this catastrophe, right, from their perspective. But yeah, it's kind of a funny and backwards U catastrophe. But yeah, he comes home to find all of his stuff being sold off. How is he different?
How's he different?
He says he's lost his reputation.
Yes, he's not as respectable as he used to be. Because remember, respectable used to mean what? Right. Right. Respectable used to mean predictable. Never to do or say anything unexpected. You could always tell a Baggins' opinion on any subject without the bother of asking him, we were told in chapter 1, right? And now, he hangs out with elves. Dwarves are still coming by. Significantly, you remember what he says to Balin and the other dwarves that are still alive when he leaves? There's another wonderful kind of Took Baggins contrast moment when they say, come back whenever you can, and when you return, the feast shall be splendid. And he says in response, when you come by, don't bother to knock. Remember the unexpected party before where they were all knocking? Now he's like, hey, don't even bother to knock. Just come in unexpectedly, right? That would be great. Tea is at 4, but you're welcome at any time. Right? So I mean, the contrast between the feast shall be splendid and tea is at 4 is another just wonderful little glimpse of sort of the two worlds there. But of course, we see his attitude different. He was not okay himself with unexpected things in chapter 1, and we saw him handling his unexpected visitors, you know, not very well, and you know, sitting on a little stool in the hallway and fanning himself while the dwarves were coming in. Clearly, he has changed in that way, so we can see why, according to the terms given originally, he is less respectable than he used to be. But what else? How else has his perspective changed? Is he, for instance, is he happy? Is he happy at home when he returns? Kelly?
It says his neighbors didn't think that he was respectable anymore, but he didn't mind. He was very content with himself.
Yes. He's very content. Can you keep reading that passage there?
Yeah, he was quite content, and the sound of the kettle on his hearth was ever after more musical than it had been, even in the quiet days before the unexpected party.
Good. What do we see here?
He really enjoys the simpler things that he enjoyed them before, but they have so much more weight now that he's been through the whole ordeal.
Yeah. Think back to On Fairy Stories and Tolkien's vocabulary in On Fairy Stories. What has happened to Bilbo?
He sort of made the journey into Fairy and back.
And now what happens? What does Tolkien predict is going to happen when he's talking about the consequences, the benefits of fantasy?
He gets to see everything through a new lens.
Yeah, recovery. Recovery is what Bilbo experiences here. Now, the sound of his kettle singing is more musical than it was before. You know, we might possibly think or guess, or one might perhaps expect that, you know, when once Bilbo has been out adventuring in the wide world, now, you know, Hobbiton is going to seem so tame and drab in comparison. When you've been... Did you notice even the parallelism, right? When you've been to the Lonely Mountain and seen the great halls and the mighty feasts and the dragon hordes, to come back to the hill, right? The hill is going to seem really puny, and your really beautiful hobbit hole beneath the hill might seem really small and shabby compared to the great dwarven halls under the mountain. But that's not what happens. In fact, it's almost the opposite of what happens. When he comes back, he loves his home even more and appreciates it even more and does see it with new eyes. His whole life is enriched by it. It's the back again part is changed because of his journey there, right? Pretty cool. What other things did you notice? Anything else that you noticed about the end of the story?
I skipped over his second visit to Rivendell, of course, and we get two more elf songs. What do you notice in Bilbo's song? Save the songs with the spiders, which, as we mentioned last time, were not really very good. His first real song,
page 269, his roads go ever on, ever, ever on song. Notice at the top of 270, Gandalf's response to his song is, "My dear Bilbo, something is the matter with you. You are not the hobbit that you were." Where do we see the change in this song? First of all, of course, just in the fact of the singing, is may we Gandalf to point that out. But what do you notice in the song, Louise?
Well, unlike his middle, it's about adventure now, traveling and not being scared to go out. It's kind of like a summary of his whole.
Yeah.
And it kind of summarizes his change.
Good, yeah. I think that this we can see this song serving as a kind of capstone, a kind of summary of what happened to him. And that contrast that you make is really great. I love that point. When he's telling riddles with Gollum during his journey, he's thinking about, you know, sun on the day, flowers and eggs and things like that. He's thinking about homey things. Now he's coming home and he's singing a song about, you know, under mountains in the moon, right? He's thinking about eyes that fire and sword have seen, and horror in the halls of stone. Look at last on meadows green and trees and hills they long have known. He's processing his experience of recovery through this song. How about the repeated line? Roads go ever, ever on. Roads go ever, ever on, under cloud and under star, yet feet that wandering have gone turn at last to home afar. The roads keep going on, but the feet don't always keep going on. The feet come back home. And that introduces that move from, you know, eyes that fire and sword have seen, look at last on meadows green. Yeah, Haley?
It's just to me that she's kind of realizing that there was a bigger world, that even if he has started out to venture out, there's adventures that he still yet has to go on, and
yeah,
there's adventures that other people are going on, and that there's a lot going on that he doesn't even think about.
Yeah, yeah, good, I agree. I mean, it connects, therefore, with Gandalf's last remark about the prophecies, right? We can see some recognition in his song here that he's just a little person in the wide world. Thank goodness, he responds, of course, when Gandalf says that. His recognition that his little story, there and back again, is only a little part of this much larger story that's going on. Okay. Fellowship of the Ring for next time. We're going to be reading, you will have noticed, although of course The Hobbit reads a lot faster than The Silmarillion, that the number of pages I asked of you was much larger than The Silmarillion. That is going to continue to be true in The Lord of the Rings. So if you hope to keep up with the reading and not fall hopelessly behind, you may want to take advantage of spring break as a time to get ahead on things. Just a little free suggestion there. But anyway, have a good break. See you in a week.
And that's all for The Hobbit. With the preliminary works, The Silmarillion and The Hobbit now done, only The Lord of the Rings lies before us. Remember that our spring break is next week, so we will start The Fellowship of the Ring on Monday, March 15th, when we will discuss the prologue and the first two chapters of Book 1. Thanks for listening, and Godspeed.